Go find it. Bob. Okay. All right. If you go on Google, the two classic books on the Confederation period are John
O. Carlisle and W.E.E.O. Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore."
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to use it to massage where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet at the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Yeah.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Author, singer, songwriter, organizer, rabble-rouser, and really all-around great guy, Cy Khan's going to be here talking about what's going on in Wisconsin. It's kind of going to be a Wisconsin night tonight, because I do believe what's going on there right now is the test case. This is the testing ground for what could happen all across this country, and the destruction of working conditions, and really the taking away of rights, the overreach of government, the radical pro-business agenda that the right really has paid for. Understand that they have bought and paid for our democracy. They have bought and paid for what they're getting. So they're getting their money's worth, and I think Bob Herbert had the best quote of all. He said, "It really doesn't matter what ordinary people want. The wealthy call the tune and the politicians dance." And that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin. The wealthy want to take away from the working people. The wealthy want that pension money. They don't want to have to pay it back. They've stolen enough of it. They've transacted enough of it away. They don't want to pay it back. Just like Social Security, just like virtually everything that you and I have fought for, just what our parents have fought for, our grandparents have fought for, they want that stuff back. And Cy Khan's one of these guys who, you know, as an organizer in the 60s, saw a lot of this stuff up hand, saw this fight firsthand. And it'll be interesting to get his perspective. In the second hour, Frank Emspeck from Workers Independent News Service going to be here. He is in Wisconsin. He was in Madison today. We're going to find out what took place, what kind of numbers were there. His take. Also in the second hour, Mark Anderson, son of a Teamster, and, you know, a guy who understands, you know, he's not a union member now, but he understands what unions have done for people in the past. He's going to talk about his piece, The Costs of Union Busting, and that will be interesting. Your calls, of course, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Like I said, Hertz's statement that it doesn't matter what you and I want. The wealth class calls the tune, and the politicians dance. And you look at what's going on in Wisconsin, you look at what's going on in Ohio, all this talk that we need to be more business friendly. We need to be more business friendly. And I keep asking, how much more business friendly do we have to be? Wages have been stagnant for 30 years. Wages have been declining, really, in real terms. You look here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're talking about an unemployment problem. The unemployment compensation system's broken. Why? Because for 25 years, employers have been getting away with only paying up to $8,000. While the working people, they get to pay on every single penny of their income. I go back in history, and, you know, I'm encouraged by what's going on today in Wisconsin. I'm encouraged by the fact that the tens of thousands of people are in the streets, that they packed the rotunda, and that there are people still there right now, that they haven't gone home. For me, I think what has to happen is they have to stay there overnight into tomorrow so that the rally tomorrow is just as powerful as today. We've seen reports of high school kids walking out of schools. We've seen just an amazing outpour of support here. But I look back to history and I ask the question, when are people going to have enough of this business mentality? And I look back today in 1933. FDR, according to History.com, escaped an assassination attempt in Miami. They say a deranged, unemployed bricklayer named Giuseppe Zangara shouts, "Too many people are starving," and fires a gun at Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was the president-elect at the time. Roosevelt had just delivered a speech from the back seat of his car when Giuseppe opened fire, hitting five people, one of them the mayor of Chicago, who was fatally wounded. Several men attacked this guy, took him to the ground. Had it not been for Roosevelt, they'd have probably killed him. And what he said, what he told the FBI, and why I think this is important, he said that the chronic stomach pain he was having led him to the action because nobody was helping him. He said, "Since my stomach hurt, I want to make even with the capitalists by killing the president. My stomach hurts long time." And, you know, it's this kind of, and I'm not advocating for this kind of extreme rage, but at some point, you know, I go back to what you were talking about, Jake, about the guy in Lebanon who stood up and was just, you know, screaming at Arlen Specter. Why? Because he was in pain. He was lashing out. As we see these kind of things continue, I think we will see, unfortunately, lashing out. And it's this kind of stuff that frightens me. Now, you look in Egypt, what's going on? 2% of the people went to the street. If we can get 2% of the people in this country to go to the street, maybe we stop some of this. Maybe we have the opportunity to turn this around, because right now the conservatives, the extreme conservatives, I don't even know if they're conservatives, the radical right, the people like Walker and like Kasich in Ohio, and I'm not even going to say our guy Tom Corbett. I'm not going to even put him on that extreme level. But you look Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and you say, you know, these are states with a strong working class ethic. And here, this governor is going to take their ability to make a better life for themselves. They're going to take it away with the stroke of a pen. Why? Because he can. Because for some odd reason, and you know, maybe it's just the political winds, we have seen this mass swing to the extreme right, not just to the right, to the extreme right, where people like Walker back in November didn't seem so far out. Now that we look at the policies that they pursue, and we start to think about what it's going to mean a year, two, five, ten down the road, this is extreme, Jake.
Problem is, Rick, it's not just that you have very conservative Republican governors. What has happened because of this, they keep describing it as a political tsunami last election. I think they're absolutely right. In these states, not only does the governor does the governor have a mandate from the people. He has the ability to get through pretty much what he wants to get through. And therein is the real scary part. These governors, you know, if they can get their party united, they can do an awful lot of damage to working people and to the future of this country and their particular states.
But I don't think they have a mandate to destroy workers' lives. I don't think they got the mandate to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater. They got what their so-called mandate was to create jobs, not to destroy the ones that we have. And as we move further down the road, this is what this kind of stuff is going to do. It's going to take the rights of workers to pursue some of the profits that they create away. Now, I give credit to the people at Vote Vets. They came out strongly in opposition to Governor Walker's, what they're calling inappropriate threat, what I'm calling criminal. This threat that he was going to use the National Guard to intimidate state workers. They said, quote, maybe the new governor doesn't understand yet, but the National Guard is not his own personal intimidation force to be mobilized to quash political dissent. And that's the key. And this is where, even if you're not someone who supports the unions, even if you're not someone who particularly cares, this is an overreach of government in epic proportions. This is what every small government, anti-government sentiment is about. Using the power of the state to quash we the people. And that's what this is. And as the Vote Vets people say, the Guard is to be used in cases of true emergencies and disasters and to help the people of Wisconsin, not to bully political opponents. Considering many veterans and Guard members are union members, it's even more inappropriate to use the Guard in this way. This is a very dangerous line for the governor to cross.
Well, I was going to mention exactly what you just did. The National Guard is really a cross-section of the population. You have professionals. You have regular working people, and some of them are, well, some of them are professionals and union people. But the comment that I really want to make, Wisconsin for a long time, up till maybe 10 years ago, was pretty progressive state. I mean, they've been in the vanguard of a lot of firsts in this country. The last couple elections, they've been a swing state. And I think what the governor did, I think he really alienated some people that were willing to give him a chance. But I really believe this is an overreach. Really an overreach. Long term, it could be disastrous. And short term, unfortunately, they can't recall him right now. But once he's in for a year, I mean, if there's enough people that are angry, they can actually start a recall petition.
After a year, and how much is going to be done in a year?
Quite a bit.
Also, the Green Bay Packers, the Super Bowl champs, they've come out in support of the working people. Their statement said, "We know that it is teamwork on and off the field that makes the Packers and Wisconsin great. As a publicly owned team, we wouldn't have been able to win the Super Bowl without the support of our fans. It is the same dedication of our public workers every day that makes Wisconsin run. They are the teachers, nurses, and child care workers who take care of us and our families. But now, in an unprecedented political attack, Governor Walker is trying to take away their rights to have a voice and bargain at work." They go on to say the right to negotiate wages and benefits is a fundamental underpinning of our middle class when workers join together and serve as a check on corporate power and help all workers by raising community standards. Wisconsin's long-standing tradition of allowing public sector workers to have a voice on the job has worked for the state since the 1930s. It has created greater consistency in the relationship between labor and management and a shared approach to public work. These public workers are Wisconsin's champions every single day, and we urge the governor and the state legislature not to take away their rights. And that's the key right there. These are people who every day get up, and they do their job every single day. They're not paid great. contrary to what we hear in the mainstream media. They don't have big lavish pensions. They don't have Cadillac healthcare plans. These are people who are just making it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Cy Khan, author, singer, songwriter, organizer, rabble rouser. We're back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public workers from across Wisconsin are rallying today at the state capitol in Madison to protest Republican Governor Scott Walker's attempted murder of public worker unions. AFSCME National Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says this gutting of collective bargaining rights is part of a nationwide attack on public workers, and in Wisconsin, it's an attempt to destroy AFSCME and other public employee unions.
They are clearly trying to not hurt us in Wisconsin. They're trying to destroy us, and we just cannot let that happen. And we're going to do everything that we possibly can to fight back.
Saunders says this is a mean-spirited attack on workers and an attempt to silence the voices of working families. He said AFSCME, the public unions, and their allied organizations will fight back like never before.
These are people who are your neighbors, your friends, your family members. They go to church with you. They're trying to play by the rules. On average, making around $40,000 a year. Our average pension payment when our folks retire after 30 or 35 years is $19,000 a year. These committed and dedicated public service workers should not be blamed for the economic crisis in this country. To silence their voices just seems to me to be completely counterproductive. And quite honestly, it's un-American to silence those voices of public sector workers.
Last week, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker threw down the gauntlet in the form of proposals that would essentially eliminate the ability of state employees to be represented by labor unions. Jesse Russell reports.
The move has galvanized supporters of public sector workers and even has conservatives that voted for Walker questioning his motives. Brenda Klein, a food service worker in Green Bay, Wisconsin, said she is shocked and angered by the proposals.
I went to the polls last November and voted to protect our freedoms from government threat and create jobs. I never dreamed this would be the result.
When presenting his proposals, Walker said firefighters and law enforcement would be exempt, but that hasn't stopped some workers in the emergency services sector from standing shoulder to shoulder with their coworkers. Janice Bobholz has been employed with the Dane County Sheriff's Department for more than 20 years and also serves as a deputy sheriff. She said as an officer, her job is to protect people from harm, and she wouldn't be doing her job if she let Walker's proposal slide.
If we allow people to deny rights and freedoms to some people, you bet your bottom dollar that in a couple years they'll be coming after everyone else, whether they are police officers or whether they work in a private company.
Bob Yon is a highway employee from Green Lake, Wisconsin, and he said he's a conservative because he wants to keep the government out of individual rights. He added that he hasn't always seen eye to eye with his union and explained why this case is different.
The issue of denying people their rights, I am in full agreement with the union. In fact, I've never been more energized to go out and fight with the tens of thousands of public employees across this state.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Out in the tavern, landed together. Strong men are hiding their sorrows. Over at Potsdam, they're at the prison. 10 men are hanging tomorrow. I only tried to organize the men I worked among, but I'm hanging in Martin, will you miss me? And Monday early, so they say, mines will open back. The coal and iron police are drinking whiskey.
You know, one of the things that I talk about quite frequently is the fact that we've forgotten our labor history. It's not taught in schools. It's not handed down generation to generation anymore. It seems to have just gone away. So when you look at something like that's going on in Wisconsin, you look at the fact that the governor is threatening to use the National Guard to intimidate the workforce, Most people don't hearken back to the days of Ludlow or the Latimer Massacre here, or a lot of the labor struggles where the state used the National Guard to put down striking workers, where sheriff's deputies gunned down people, shooting them in the back like we saw up here in Latimer. I think it's something we need to think about. A great quote I came across was from our next guest. He says, freedom is a hard won thing, and every generation has to win it again. And I look at what's going on in Wisconsin, and boy, Sycon, you couldn't have been more accurate. Cy, welcome to the program.
Rick, it's good to be back in my home state of Pennsylvania. How are you?
I'm great. You know, I got to be honest. I'm excited by what I'm seeing coming out of Wisconsin. Tens of thousands of people in the street, tens of thousands of people standing up and saying no, fighting back.
Well, you've got an entrenched and very democratic labor movement in Wisconsin. It's been under very fine leadership. David Newby, who was the state Fed president for many years, the close friend, he's a progressive, and somebody who was committed to building at the grassroots. And that includes the streets. That includes the picket line. I mean, Rick, you were talking very eloquently about forgetting our labor history. And that's not just the history of our union, although it is the history of our union. It's the history of every working person, everybody's great-grandmother, everybody's great-great-uncle, all the people who, you know, as it says in the Great Labor Anthem, solidarity forever, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. And, you know, and then the song goes on to say, now we stand outcast and starving, this the wonders we have made. That's exactly what's happening in our country today. It's what's happening in Wisconsin, which is a class war, but it's a class war declared by the haves against the have-nots.
Yeah, and you look at what's going on, and again, you know, this last election, we saw this massive sweep of not just Republicans, but radical, pro-business, anti-worker Republicans.
Well, sort of goes hand in hand, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in talking about this with folks here today, you know, most people didn't see this coming. And I've been saying, look, this is coming. We're going to have an onslaught of attacks. You need to be prepared for this.
And, go ahead, Rick.
And I think most people were caught unaware by what Walker has done.
Well, you know, no one should have been surprised. The Republican right, the Tea Party, has been unrelenting in its war on working people, in its war on unions, in its war on public sector unions in particular. Here we have Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, right next door to where I live in North Carolina, saying that she will use the power of the state to prevent people from organizing into the machinist union at the Boeing plant in North Charleston, South Carolina. That is a complete violation of the United States Constitution. You know, I think most folks either never knew or were never taught or never learned, but the right to organize, the right to unionize is right there in the Constitution of the United States. It's the First Amendment to the Constitution, Article 1 of the Bill of Rights. Most people know it as freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. It is all those things, but then it also says, Congress shall make no law, but you get these other provisions, and then it says, to abridge the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition for a redress of grievances.
Yep.
That is the right to organize. That is the right to unionize. So when the conservative Republicans, when the Tea Party, talk about unions being un-American, they are attacking our own Constitution.
You know, the one that they so love, but really don't understand and want to repeal half the amendments.
Well, exactly. But, you know, What is going on? You know, Rick, you said that people shouldn't have been surprised in Wisconsin. No working person, no union member should have been surprised by the last 40 years. Because ever since the infamous Powell Memorandum in the 40s that was commissioned by the United States Chamber of Commerce, we have had a declared war against working people. And then by working people, I don't just mean people in the shipyards and the mines. I mean everybody who has to go to work every day is one paycheck away from economic disaster. And basically, the multinational corporations decided 50 years ago that owning 90% of everything wasn't enough for them, and that they wanted everything else.
They wanted
and
all.
That, they want it all. And they are quite honest and open about it. Here we have 4 million people have lost their homes due to the intransigent irresponsibility of the banks and the bank regulators. 8 million people have lost their jobs. People who had good jobs, good union jobs, that allow them to send their kids to college, allow them to put their grandparents in a decent nursing home. Those folks have been driven to minimum wage jobs at the Walmart. We have seen the dismantling of programs that help everybody, to help kids. I mean, we're concerned about our balance of trade. We're concerned about our economic competitiveness. And meanwhile, we're slashing and burning the funding that goes to schools, to basic education, to art, to music, to culture. We're slashing teachers' salaries. And it's not just the public employees who are going to suffer. This is what I think most people don't understand. There is a backlash. People say, well, public employees they're making too much money, and I'm not making enough. Well, Part B is correct. Part of the reason that in Wisconsin and places like that, that everyday people who do work hard for a living, they are angry because they don't have what public employees have got in terms of basic wages, in terms of benefits, in terms of protection on the job. But the answer is not to take that away from public employees who, you know, I want to know how many of the folks who are out there saying, well, public employees make too much money, are willing to teach a class of 40 third graders day after day. I want to know how many of them are willing to be firefighters and go into burning buildings, how many of them are going to be willing to do the hard work that public servants do.
Yep.
But the answer is not to tear down those of a decent standard of living. The answer is to rebuild the well-being that every working person in America deserves.
I'm right there with you, Syed. It's the line that I've been talking about for the longest time. Are you angry that they get it or that you don't? If you're angry that they get it, I can't help you. But if you're angry that you don't, organize. Come together. Very,
exactly.
Very simple.
Exactly.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Syed Khan, organizer, rabble-rouser, author, singer, songwriter, and really all-around great guy. I got to get a plug in for your book. It's called Creative Community Organizing, A Guide for Rabble-Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. A fantastic book that I have enjoyed, and some of the stories in there are just fantastic. The reason I called you back on is, you know, I'm looking at the history of this, and I wanted to go a little bit of history because, as you said earlier, you're a Pennsylvania guy, born in Center County, right?
That's absolutely right.
Not too far from here.
Born and raised.
And up there, the big movement was the Molly Maguires.
Well, and that was before our time, too. And here's the history, because I doubt if they're teaching it in the civics classes in Pennsylvania today. The Molly Maguires were immigrant Irish coal miners in the hard coal fields, in the anthracite fields back in the 1870s. And they, you know, coming from Ireland and being, you know, class-conscious working people and being coal miners. Coal miners have always had a profound class consciousness and a often radical trade union consciousness, coming out of the level of danger and the closeness and the working conditions, that they fought for better working conditions in the Pennsylvania coal fields. And they were opposed to the Frederick Cower, who was the president of the Reading Railroad, but who also owned all of the coal mines in that part of the country. Cower had a private army. Think of this. He had a private army called the Coal and Iron Police. They were people that he hired, that he paid, that he armed, and they were there to keep order, so-called, and that was in quotes, keep order, in the coal fields, which they did by terror and assassination. And Pennsylvania, southeast Pennsylvania, the part of that of our state that you, where Jim Thorpe is now, we used to be called Moshchunk, and we're in Pottsville, and you know, all on up and down the Schuylkill River, where the deep open pit mines were, and the deep mines were of hard coal, the immigrant Irish organized, and there was really an armed battle between the Coal and Iron Police and the unionized miners. Now, they weren't in a formal union in the modern sense, but they were organized and they were militant and they defended their rights and their safety conditions and their wages. and eventually cause so much trouble to the people in power that Frederick Gower, again, the guy who owned the mines, who owned the railroad, and who owned the Coal and Iron Police, hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which had made money spying in the Civil War for both North and the South, working both sides, hired them to infiltrate the Molly Maguires. And they were successfully infiltrated, the infiltrated third state's evidence, and 12 Mollies were hanged on the same day up and down this, along the Schuylkill River. It was the largest officially sanctioned mass execution in U.S. history. There were larger mass executions of Native Americans, but those were more in the nature of mass lynching. This is the, well, think, and think of that, that a dozen Molly Maguires, a dozen immigrant coal miners were murdered by the state, fundamentally for trying to establish their rights as working people. And that's Rick, when he referred earlier to the use of the National Guard, which has been threatened by the governor of Wisconsin, that is completely and totally in that tradition. We've seen that again and again and again. We saw it in the 1934 general strike in textiles, when all across the South, the National Guard was called out, and they had machine guns on the roofs of the mills. They had barbed wire enclosures, 10,000 people behind them. And then sometimes, in one of the more interesting turns in labor history, during the sit-in strikes that started actually not in Flint, Michigan, but in Decatur, Georgia, Fisher Body Plant Number 2, when the auto manufacturers went to Governor John P. Altgeld of Illinois and said, you must call out the National Guard. You must suppress these militants who have taken over our plants that are refusing to leave. Altgeld, who was Irish, and despite the name, his grandfather had been hanged by the British as an Irish revolutionary, said, I will not use the power of the state to intervene in an argument between management and labor. And he refused to call out the National Guard. And as a result, we saw the establishment of United Auto Workers as a very powerful bargaining force. And the children of those strikers went on to become nurses and college professors and small business people and to become elected officials and become part of the fabric of democracy that happens when you give people a good wage for a good day's work, when you make it possible for them to get an education, when you liberate their spirits and their intellects. And that's how you build a democracy. That's how you build a strong country, not along the low road that the governor of Wisconsin is taking.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing, you know, and I've taken some heat from a couple of people by saying that I think this is our generation, this generation's PATCO. This is that moment in history where I think Wisconsin is the testing ground. If it is not met with mass resistance, it's going to sweep across the Northeast, and unions as we know it, I think will be gone.
I agree. I mean, I think there have only ever been so many counterweights to the power of the multinational corporations. And the labor movement is first and foremost the counterweight to absolutely unbridled corporate power. So, and something like one third of public employees are union members, whereas in the private sector, it's been driven down to 6.9%. Now, this is not that, you know, every poll that's ever been taken says that at least half of American workers want to be part of a union. It's just that with our regressive laws and the fact that corporations can't get away with anything, that's the only reason that people don't have the right to a union. In Europe, they would have the right to a union. So, yeah, absolutely. If we don't make a stand here, then it's very dark times, not just for the labor movement, but for working people, including the hundreds of millions of people who work and don't have the protection of union.
So where do you think this is going to go? I'm hoping that we see mass resistance. I'm hoping that this turns into a movement of people who are going to sustain, going to continue on. I'm curious, as an organizer from your position, how would you deal with this?
Well, you know, I would be out talking to every member of the Guard in Wisconsin that I could reach. I mean, I think if the Egyptian army can make it clear that they will not turn against the Egyptian people, then the members of the Wisconsin National Guard, who have sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and daughters and granddaughters working in the public sector as teachers, as social workers, as physicians, as nutritionists, as nurses' aides, they family. And I will obey the law, but I will not obey an attack on the Constitution that that illegally uses the power of government to keep people from their rights. And I think that if I were in Wisconsin, the first thing I would be doing would be go to talk to every guardswoman, every guardsman, and saying, you have to be on the side of family, you have to be on the side of community. We need a better life for everybody in our state, and this is not the way to get it.
Uh-huh.
And just to hope that a lot of people in the Guard will say to the governor, Governor, we signed up to defend this country. We didn't sign up to attack its own people.
Yeah, you know, I read the Vote Vets position on this earlier in the first segment, saying, look, you know, we're here for, you know, for disasters and to help the state, not to be used as a intimidation force for your political ideology.
Yeah, and I would be asking every member of the Guard to sign that, and former members of the Guard, and generals, and Guards people in other states. This is not what the Guard is there for. This is not what the Guard is there for.
You know what I find interesting, that the very people who claim they want small government, that they want less intrusive government, are the first people who use government to get between individuals, between workers, between you know, people in their bedroom, whatever. They're there for them.
Well, that's a good point, Rick. I'm with you there, buddy.
Amazing, amazing stuff. I'm really hoping this goes the right way.
Well, you know, a whole lot is counting on it. Let's give the right kind of salute to the courageous people in Wisconsin who are going to be holding that front line. And let's turn out to support them.
Yeah, absolutely. Psycon, author of Creative Community Organizing, a guide for rabble-rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. Psycon.com is the website. You can get there from our site at thericksmithshow.com. Psy, great talking to you.
Hey, Rick. Always listen. Call me anytime, buddy. But it's something like this, you know where my heart is.
All righty. Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thanks for lifting this up for everybody.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Holding a red rose, waiting for sunrise. King of the Mollies, Jack Kehoe. The Trappist Sprung and Molly sons are traveling into time. Murdered by the man who hoped to hang her. But the aboard souls of Union men are all with her tonight. And the Pennsylvania pits are dark with anger.
Your proud defender of a working class majority, Rick Smith.
Most of us would not consider $600,000 to be good pay for a year's work. We'd consider it to be a bonanza. But then, we're not a Wall Street greedhead. Lloyd Blankfein, however, is. As boss banker at Goldman Sachs, he was not happy to draw only $600,000 last year, so he recently got Goldman's compliant board to more than triple his base salary this year to $2 million. Bear in mind that base salary on Wall Street is just for showing up, not the total pay they haul off at year's end. Bonuses, stock options, and other bundles of money are thrown in to rocket executive pay into the greedosphere. Add up all the extras, and Blankfein's total take last year was not a peonish $600,000, but $13.2 million, plus a limousine, of course. It's useless, though, to try telling Lloyd that such pay is excessive, unseemly, greedy. He's measured what he got last year in terms of the haul he made in 2007, when he and his merry band of banksters were busy crashing our economy, costing millions of Americans their jobs, homes, and middle-class hopes. For his splendid work that year, Blankfein made off with more than $68 million in personal pay. Still, grabbing a $13 million paycheck last year, while, thanks in part to him, millions of people got no paycheck at all, puts the triple I in narcissistic. Blankfein's flaming sense of self-worth is magnified by the fact that Goldman Sachs had a lousy 2010. Its stock value stagnated, profits plummeted by a third, and it had to pay $500 million for defrauding its own customers. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this failure on the watch of a guy who now feels entitled to a bigger paycheck. As a symbol of Wall Street's mindless greed-headedness, Lloyd Blankfein bobblehead dolls should be distributed across America. Better yet, how about Blankfein voodoo dolls? What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can also podcast our program from thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I go back to my conversation with Cy Khan, who I just think is a great guy, and his book is a fabulous, fabulous read, taking you back into the 60s, into labor history a little bit. A story he tells about actually taking a former slave who was born a slave to register to vote. Just an amazing, amazing guy, an amazing story. But you look at the reality. The reality is the investor class, they don't want you to have a voice. They want to take away your ability to stand up for yourself. They want to take that away. And I got to tell you, right now is the time for people to take to the streets, because business doesn't give a damn about you. And I look at this Wall Street Journal piece that I came across. That just, you know, it's something I've been talking about for a while. And remember, North Carolina used to be the state that produced all the furniture for the U.S. We used to chop down trees right there. You'd make it into boards. You turned it into furniture, and we would sell it throughout the country. What we're doing now is we're cutting down those trees. We're putting them onto boats. We're shipping them over to China. They're chopping them into boards, cutting them into boards, and making finished product and shipping them back here. And that's all fine, well, and good in the bizarre world of American trade policy. And this piece in the Wall Street Journal, understand, this is the Wall Street Journal. This is the newspaper of the investor class. So this kind of thing should be very nice for them. Here's what they write. Some U.S. furniture makers and their lawyers have found a reliable way to extract cash from Chinese competitors deemed by U.S. officials to have dumped their products in the U.S., selling them at unfairly low prices. Each year since 2006, they have asked the Commerce Department to review the U.S. duties paid by Chinese manufacturers on imports of wooden bedroom furniture. Many Chinese firms, fearing a steep rise in duties, agreed within months each time to pay a cash settlement to their U.S. competitors in return for being removed from the review list. William Silverman, a lawyer representing U.S. furniture retailers, one of the big importers of Chinese products, said everybody in the industry in the U.S. and China understands these payments are a clever shakedown. So here's what's going on. Understand this. Because, look, U.S. companies don't care about you. They don't care about the American worker. What do they care about? Profit. That's it. Pure and simple. What they're putting in their pocket. So if they can cut down the trees here in the U.S., ship them over to China, have the Chinese do all the work, take all the risk, do all that stuff, ship it back here, sell it, and then the Chinese companies pay them for doing nothing, that's a win-win for them. That's profit in their pocket. They don't care that they're not producing a product. They don't care that they're not hiring American workers. They don't care. Representatives of the furniture makers, including Lazy Boy Incorporated and Vaughn Bassett Furniture Company, say the payments are legal. Late last month, those two companies and about 15 other U.S. firms sought the latest review listing 110 Chinese firms. About $13 million was paid to a group of 20 U.S. furniture makers from 2006 to 2009, according to the ITC report. Are you getting this? Are you getting this? They're shaking down these Chinese companies. They've allowed their manufacturing to go overseas. They've allowed this to happen. And now they're filling their pockets. Two of the ITC commissioners, a woman named Charlotte Land, one of the commissioners, said that she was very, very troubled by the settlement, adding, I cannot figure out for the life of me how they are actually legal, these payments. I go back again and tell you, they don't really care. They really don't care about you or any American worker. What they care about lining their pockets. It's not about making this country strong. It's not about making this country independent. It's about none of that. It's about how do they enrich that small number? How do we make the very, very wealthy even wealthier? Because the American worker isn't benefiting from this. The American consumer really isn't benefiting from it because they push the price up, and it's even more profit. So, you know, I look to this, Jake, and it's one of those things where you go, when are we going to wake up? When are our politicians going to wake up to the reality that these companies who we seem to want to bow at their feet and call them these benevolent wonders, when are we going to wake up and realize that they really don't give a rat's behind about us, this country, or anything having to do with right here at home?
Well, as I want to go into later on in the show, there are some CEOs, not because they're necessarily union-friendly, but out of enlightened self-interest, have said, look, this show isn't making it. The system we're using isn't making it, and we need some fundamental change. These are CEOs of corporate America, which we disagree with probably 90% of the time. They're coming out publicly. They're writing books. And as I said, maybe later in the show we'll get into that. But it's about time, you know, I hope for the sake of this country, isn't it? And that's a very real fear. That we've gone too far.
1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situation. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make this great happen.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Michelle Bachmann was on the Laura Ingraham Show today, made a couple of bizarre comments. I hope my wife's listening because this is one of those things that will get her blood boiling. She said, and she ripped into Michelle Obama over breastfeeding, calling the First Lady's promotion of nursing an example of a nanny state. You know, Bachmann, who's, you know, talking about running to be president, made her comments, you know, on the insane radio program of Laura Ingraham. Now, understand, Obama's pushing for a tax break for breast pumps, which, you know, again, I wish they had when we bought ours. It was $350 for one of these industrial strength double milking, you know, machines, which, you know, we put to great use with three children because my wife, you know, and very proudly so, breastfed all three of our children for, I think 14, 15 months apiece, which, you know, again, you know, is the best thing for them. So what I find interesting is, here are the family values people. Here are the family values people who don't want to encourage this kind of behavior. Now, Michelle Bachmann says she's given birth to five babies, and she breastfed every one of her kids, and good for her. But she said, to think that government has to go out and buy my breast pump, that's a new definition of a nanny state. Well, what about the people who can't afford them? I mean, $300 out of pocket seems to be quite costly for some. And I find it interesting that the same people who are talking about family values are the same ones who are doing absolutely everything they can possibly do to make sure that families suffer. And it's amazing. You know, again, I look at Mike Lee, the guy from Utah, the billionaire from West Virginia who, you know, made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it from grandparents who exploited children. And their parents who worked their fingers to the bone just so Mr. Racy there could rail against child labor laws. And you look at this crazy woman in Missouri, State Senator Jane Cunningham, who, you know, again, I absolutely have to read this piece of legislation because I don't know how else. I read it last night, and I have to read it again because I don't know how else to explain how insane this woman is. This is what she wrote. Senate Bill 222 in Missouri modifies the child labor laws. That's the title of it. It reads, this act modifies the child labor laws. It eliminates the prohibition on employment of children under 14 years old. So we can have kids 7, 8 years old working in the looms again, working in the coal mine. What the heck? Restrictions, it goes on to say, restrictions on the number of hours and restrictions on a child may work during the day are also removed. So there are no number of hours, no maximum hours, and, you know, no certain days. No number of days, no restrictions whatsoever. So we can have kids under 14 years old working in the mines as many hours as the employer wants and as many days as they want according to this legislation. Goes on to say, it also repeals the requirement that a child ages 14 to 15 obtain a work certificate or work permit in order to be employed. So heaven forbid we know who's in the workplace. Heaven forbid we know which children are doing this. She goes on to say, this is my part. This is the part that really flips me out. Children under 16 will also be allowed to work in any capacity in a motel, resort, or hotel where sleeping accommodations are furnished. Are you freaking kidding me? I mean, stop and think about the scenario you're setting up here. You've got a hotel, motel, resort, whatever you want to call it, with kids under 16. Are we not asking for severe trouble? I mean, am I missing something here, Jake?
No, you're not.
It also removes the authority of the director of the Division of Labor Standards to inspect employers who employ children and to require them to keep certain records for children they employ. It also repeals the presumption that the presence of a child in a workplace is evidence of employment. So, you look at this and understand the federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, does protect children in Missouri. Understand that. There are federal laws on this, so this is one of those things that, while they put it out there and it looks dangerous, thank God the federal government has put some minimum levels in. So this isn't going to go as crazy as it reads. But this is their intent. These are the family values, people. And this is how far they've gone. I mean, this, Jake, is insane. This is absolutely insane.
It's as we talked last night, Rick, some of these people are intent to push labor laws back literally 100 years, and this is one of them.
You know, I think, you know, I've got children, 2, 4, and 8. I think about putting my daughter, 8 years old, into the workforce, having her work at a hotel where sleeping accommodations are available, are furnished. Really? Is that the kind of country we've become? Is this the image of ourselves that we want to see when we look in the mirror? I sure hope not. And I'm working on getting this crazy woman to come on our program. I have sent them an email. I want to talk to her about this because this cannot go unanswered. This cannot go unattacked. This cannot go without somebody standing up. Generations fought too hard to make sure the children had the right to go to school, fought too hard to keep kids out of the mines and the looms and off the factory assembly lines, fought too hard for that stuff. And working people in this country had better wake up, because all those things that generations before us fought, bled, and died for are being stolen away, being ripped out from underneath us. And it better come at a price. And it better come with somebody take to the streets like they're doing in Wisconsin. And I would say this Senate Bill 222, which, you know, I'm told isn't going to go anywhere. But the reality is that somebody was crazy enough. Somebody was nutty and stupid enough to say, oh, this is a great idea. I think we should have kids under 16 working in hotels where they're sleeping accommodations furnished, because, you know, we like trouble. We like having children taken advantage of, because that's what this piece of legislation says to me. Kids, oh, what the heck? Let's exploit them. They're not that smart. We can rip them off. We don't have to keep any records. So we can cheat them. We can steal their wages, because wage theft in this country is rampant. There's just another class of folks we can rob, steal from, pillage, beat, abuse. Going back 100 years. Going back to the good old days, like when John Racy's grandparents started a business. You know, the way things used to be, when you could exploit children and, you know, steal from their parents. The good old days, you know? Before all those pesky labor laws. Before you had to pay that minimum wage. Before workman's comp and unemployment. Before any of that. When you could just use people up and throw them to the curb. The way things used to be. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with Frankie M. Speck.
Proud to
center of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public workers from across Wisconsin are rallying today at the state capitol in Madison to protest Republican Governor Scott Walker's attempted murder of public worker unions. AFSCME National Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says this gutting of collective bargaining rights is part of a nationwide attack on public workers, and in Wisconsin, it's an attempt to destroy AFSCME and other public employee unions.
They are clearly trying to not hurt us in Wisconsin. They're trying to destroy us, and we just cannot let that happen. And we're going to do everything that we possibly can to fight back.
Saunders says this is a mean-spirited attack on workers and an attempt to silence the voices of working families. He said AFSCME, the public unions, and their allied organizations will fight back like never before.
These are people who are your neighbors, your friends, your family members. They go to church with you. They're trying to play by the rules. On average, making around $40,000 a year. Our average pension payment when our folks retire after 30 or 35 years is $19,000 a year. These committed and dedicated public service workers should not be blamed for the economic crisis in this country. To silence their voices just seems to me to be completely counterproductive. And quite honestly, it's un-American to silence those voices of public sector workers.
Last week, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker threw down the gauntlet in the form of proposals that would essentially eliminate the ability of state employees to be represented by labor unions. Jesse Russell reports.
The move has galvanized supporters of public sector workers. It even has conservatives that voted for Walker questioning his motives. Brenda Klein, a food service worker in Green Bay, Wisconsin, said she is shocked and angered by the proposals.
I went to the polls last November and voted to protect our freedoms from government threat and create jobs. I never dreamed this would be the result.
When presenting his proposals, Walker said firefighters and law enforcement would be exempt, but that hasn't stopped some workers in the emergency services sector from standing shoulder to shoulder with their coworkers. Janice Bobholz has been employed with the Dane County Sheriff's Department for more than 20 years and also serves as a deputy sheriff. She said as an officer, her job is to protect people from harm, and she wouldn't be doing her job if she let Walker's proposal slide.
If we allow people to deny rights and freedoms to some people, you bet your bottom dollar that in a couple years they'll be coming after everyone else, whether they are police officers or whether they work in a private company.
Bob Yon is a highway employee from Green Lake, Wisconsin, and he said he's a conservative because he wants to keep the government out of individual rights. He added that he hasn't always seen eye to eye with his union and explained why this case is different.
The issue of denying people their rights, I am in full agreement with the union. In fact, I've never been more energized to go out and fight with the tens of thousands of public employees across this state.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. During the break, someone told me that Fake News on Fox was live on location in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and they found no really unhappy workers. In fact, they found no one at all. So all of this talk of unhappy state workers is completely lost, evidently, on Fox News there, as they report from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And again, you can depend on Fake News on Fox to be right on top of the breaking stories of the day. One of the best quotes that I've gotten out of this whole thing that's unfolding in Madison, Wisconsin, comes from State Representative Mark Pocan. He says, rather than sitting down and talking to public employees, Walker's bill just steals their most basic rights. The right for public servants to organize in an effort to protect themselves and their family has been on our books for over half a century. He says, in one fell swoop, Governor Walker is trying to institute a sweeping, radical, and dangerous notion that will return Wisconsin to the days when land barons and railroad tycoons controlled the political elites in Madison. The days of employees having a say with their employers will be over. And that's what this is about. This is about stealing the rights of workers to have that voice. Someone who was there today in Madison while the fake news on Fox people were over in Fond du Lac, Frank Emspeck from Workers Independent News.
Hi.
Was in Madison. Frank, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, this is great. Let me just say a couple things, though. First of all, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 people were in the state capitol today insisting and demanding that this bill be killed and saying we're not going to be disenfranchised, we're not going to tolerate this. And secondly, in the middle of the day, at some point, probably about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a whole contingent of firefighters in uniform marched down the street in solidarity with the people that were already there. So even though Scott Walker said, well, firefighters and police could be exempt from this, they didn't buy it. And in fact, this was a tremendous show of solidarity. It was just remarkable. There wasn't any union that anybody could think of that wasn't there this afternoon and tomorrow as well. So this is a huge, huge statewide outpouring. But there's even more. I just finished the last of the meetings about maybe 15 minutes ago. And on the way out the door, I was speaking about some of these things on the panel. Out the door, somebody stops me and says, he wants you to meet some people. And I met about 14 or 15 high school kids from the two or three of the high schools here in the city. At about 11:30 this morning, the largest high schools, the kids, the students said, we're not going to tolerate this. We're going to protect our teachers. We're going to protect our education. And the schools are, in each case, about 3 miles from the state capitol. Left school and marched to the state capitol. So in addition to the 20,000 or so working people that were there, there was another 500 or 1,000 high school students saying, we're not going to sit back and watch our education be destroyed. This is a remarkable event, just remarkable.
And their future. I mean, you know, look what's going on in Egypt and around the Middle East. And I've been saying, don't be surprised if you see that kind of energy come here while the politicians here are saying, oh, what a great thing it is to happen there. It could happen right here, and it should happen right here.
You know, our position on Worker Independent News, when we interviewed the teacher from Egypt last Friday, and it's on our website, nice long interview. You know, our view is that they're building democracy in Egypt, the people there, and particularly the working people, because the working people are who came out Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, and finally the army said, we're not going to be able to tolerate this and dump Mubarak. But it's the same story. When people are disenfranchised, which is what's happening here, and when there's an attempt to drive the labor movement out of the political process, because this has nothing to do with the budget. You know, we're talking about limitations on collective bargaining. We're saying you can't talk about anything except wages. So working conditions, fairness, grievances, discrimination, forget it. The governor's position is no negotiations, and he canceled, incidentally, the contracts, you know, that they're all done on March 13th. So you have that, but if you're talking about the budget, what business of it of his to deal with union security issues, the dues check off, and an open shop? That has nothing to do with the state budget. That has everything to do with trying to drive unions out of the political process and disenfranchise working people. And that, I think, has really, really gotten people's ire here, that who is this guy to say that we are not going to be able to participate? And it's really got, I mean, I think that's part of the energy that we see here.
You know, how much of this do you think, and I'm looking at this, and I got to be honest, I'm pretty excited because I think this is going to be that energizing moment. I said, you know, I've been saying this could be our generation. This is going to be our generation's PATCO, and we're going to be judged by what response happens from Friday forward. I think this could be that catalyst moment.
Well, that's interesting to say that because on our panel tonight, I was sitting next to gentleman from Chicago, and we were both active during the PATCO situation. I passed him a note and said, you know, this reminds me of PATCO. And then he talked about that, and I said, well, in Lynn, Massachusetts, where I was then, I was an officer of Local 201 of the IUE. The vice president and I, Kevin Marr, went down to the airport, to Logan, to see what we could do to help out. And a miraculous thing happened. At that time, there was a crossroads and one traffic light, and if something got stuck in the middle, it blocked the airport. Well, I had a dart and I had a distributor cap in it, and the most amazing accident happened. It fell out.
Kind of hate when that happens.
Yeah, and we couldn't find it for a long time. Finally, you know, a couple hours later, I guess we found it because we were able to move the car. But I think at this stage of the game, looking back, we could have won that strike. We could have won Patco, and the loss was like Waterloo for us. I think now people understand that, and I believe that the leadership of the trade union movement is going to say, we can't go through this again. We're not going to do that. I hope that's the case. It certainly is here where people have stood up, and everybody, you know, that you could imagine was at the State House today. And clearly a unified front. Nobody was willing to buy the separation between private sector and public sector. Huge private sector outpouring today from every union, whether they're in the AFL-CIO or not.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Frank Emspeck, Workers Independent News, their website, laborradio.org. He's the producer of those wonderful wind clips you hear at the top of each hour. You know, Frank, I'm looking at this as the test ground. This is the, that testing ground that could roll across Ohio into Pennsylvania here, New Jersey, you know, basically all the other.
Well, there are 20 states, actually. I happen to just have in front of me the list because we used it earlier, where there's a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. And you hit it right on the head. Aside from the fact that some of these things are being tried in places like Illinois and, I mean, Missouri, you've got Ohio and Indiana on this list. And there's already legislation that was proposed today in the Ohio Senate, I believe. And remember, Ohio is the birthplace of Taft, as in Taft and Hartley, right. The Hartley Act. And similar legislation. And so our sense is that at the Worker Independent News, and I think almost anybody analyzing this, is that this is part of an overall coordinated strategy to once and for all drive the nails into labor's coffin, if they can. Because if you can eviscerate the unions, destroy their publicity, destroy their ability to have members and bargain in three of the most union-heavy states, you essentially gut the national trade union movement. And I think that's what's going on here. And I think this is all part of a strategy, a well-thought-out strategy, a dangerous strategy to disenfranchise workers in time for the election in 2012.
Let me ask you this, you know, in looking at this, because this can go two ways. I mean, the right is well-funded. There's a lot of corporate money going into this because the stakes are very, very lucrative for them.
Right.
What are the chances that this does what it's doing in Wisconsin right now, where tens of thousands of people are marching in the street? What do you see the possibilities of this actually energizing the workforce? Because here in Pennsylvania, I don't know if you know, 51% of the union vote went to a Republican senator.
Well, it's the same situation here, and the reason we found people who voted for Walker and asked them what they think now, the people that we interviewed in our show today, was to find out what they thought now. And so we know here that a substantial number of organized teachers who are now clearly on the block voted for Walker, and the reasons were, as our people expressed, they were upset and sort of low information, high upsetness. And so I think it's our challenge here to win back the trust of our fellow members, never mind the millions of people who we have to approach. But I think it may be an energizing moment. I hope it's an energizing moment. But I believe we also have to look beyond just ourselves and say the trade union movement, all of us who are interested in this kind of thing and who've supported it for years and years, that we recognize that our duty is to all the people in the country and that we have to come up with ideas and programs and plans that address all of the people that are living, working people, whether they're in the union or not. And I think that way we'll grow our union. The young trade union program, for instance, that we've talked about before is an example of reaching out to young people and saying, we're here for you. We're not interested in screwing you. We're interested here in improving educational opportunity and so forth. So I think that part and parcel of any movement to maintain worker rights has got to be envisioned as worker rights in the broadest possible sense, or else we're going to be, I think, attacked for being a special interest, which is just ludicrous.
Right. Well, let me ask you, tomorrow another rally, I understand, in Madison?
Yeah. The idea, nobody knows what's going to happen in the legislature. Right now, the Republicans have a 19-14 margin in the Senate and about 30-20 or so in the House. And they have the governor. In the past, there have been a whole number of Republicans here who, even though they don't agree with unions necessarily, have supported their right to exist and, in fact, voted for collective bargaining. The grandfather of one of the guys is actually one of the people who helped write the first sort of model for a National Labor Relations Act in 1935. But who knows? Anyway, so the idea tomorrow is that people will mass at the State House from other parts of the state, and they will be there all day, just like today. And then we'll see sort of what happens on Thursday. The governor has tried to fast-track this vote so that the vote could take place as early as Thursday or Friday. There are people who are opposed to this, both within his party and, of course, the Democratic Party. It's not clear that they're going to be able to delay the vote, and we don't know how the vote's going to turn out, obviously. So,
is there any chance of derailing this? I mean, as you said, there are a number of labor, maybe not friendly, but not anti-labor Republicans. Maybe there are some people who have a lot of labor folks in their district. You put enough pressure on them, they see their own demise in 2012.
Well, exactly. And there are a couple of areas of the state which have always had Republican representatives but have a very, very high percentage of working people vote in those states, in those districts. So those representatives have certainly been targeted today for discussions and whatnot. I think that somebody said to me that one of the things that people had looked at was the auto dealerships, where a lot of them are active politically in their communities, like every place, and they had originally supported Walker and some of these ideas, and I've heard, but I don't have been able to confirm it, that a large number of people have called their own dealerships up and said, hey, if you go for this, you know, forget about us ever buying a car there again. And rumor has it that the dealers have called their representatives and said, maybe this isn't such a smart move. But I don't know that that's the case. It just appears that that's the case at the moment.
Well, we shall see, and I'm looking forward to see what happens tomorrow as this unfolds.
Well, just remember, tomorrow is still tomorrow, right? Right now it's about 9:15, and I left the crowd to come over and do this call. The crowd is on its way. We had another community meeting this evening at the Orpheum Theater, which is the largest theater in town, and people went up to join the Teaching Assistants Association. The Teaching Assistants Association right now is camped out in the state capitol, and it's not clear that they're leaving.
Good.
Now, we don't know, again, yet. It's still early. The capitol has not been closed as of this moment, but people from the Teaching Assistants Association have said something along the lines of that we're citizens, it's our building. We'll see what plays out later in the evening. I don't know if they're going to be thrown out or whether they're going to leave or what, but they've called it a stint, so it doesn't sound like people are going anyplace.
Well, if and when things break, let us know.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. We want to keep on top of this because I think this is the story of our time. Frank Emspecht, head guy over at Workers Independent News, website laborradio.org. Thanks for all you do, and thanks for those great win clips.
All right, thank you. Take it easy.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
of us would not consider $600,000 to be good pay for a year's work. We'd consider it to be a bonanza. But then, we're not a Wall Street greedhead. Lloyd Blankfein, however, is. As boss banker at Goldman Sachs, he was not happy to draw only $600K last year, so he recently got Goldman's compliant board to more than triple his base salary this year to $2 million. Bear in mind that base salary on Wall Street is just for showing up, not the total pay they haul off at year's end. Bonuses, stock options, and other bundles of money are thrown in to rocket executive pay into the greenosphere. Add up all the extras, and Blankfein's total take last year was not a peonish $600,000, but $13.2 million, plus a limousine, of course. It's useless, though, to try telling Lloyd that such pay is excessive, unseemly, greedy. He's measuring what he got last year in terms of the haul he made in 2007, when he and his merry band of banksters were busy crashing our economy, costing millions of Americans their jobs, homes, and middle-class hopes. For his splendid work that year, Blankfein made off with more than $68 million in personal pay. Still, grabbing a $13 million paycheck last year, while, thanks in part to him, millions of people got no paycheck at all, puts the triple I in narcissistic. Blankfein's flaming sense of self-worth is magnified by the fact that Goldman Sachs had a lousy 2010. Its stock value stagnated, profits plummeted by a third, and it had to pay $500 million for defrauding its own customers. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this failure on the watch of a guy who now feels entitled to a bigger paycheck. As a symbol of Wall Street's mindless greed-headedness, Lloyd Blankfein bobblehead dolls should be distributed across America. Better yet, how about Blankfein voodoo dolls? What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, I look at what's going on there in Wisconsin, and tomorrow, like Frank said, right now it's still going on. It's going to probably go on throughout the night and into tomorrow. What we're seeing on the tubes and on the Twitter, I'm going to see a lot of college classes canceled tomorrow. They're not going on strike. They're not, you know, making official action. As one of the tweets pointed out, this one person said his professor sent out email saying they're not going to hold classes because they want to go protest something they don't agree with. So it's not, you know, they're not going on strike, but they're going to stand up for their right to have their voices heard.
And how many times on this show have we said maybe it's time for the American people to go to the street?
I've been calling for this.
That's the very heart. The First Amendment is the very heart of our democracy. And getting out there in the street is your way of expressing your First Amendment rights. And that's beautiful. And, in fact, if you got to intermix that with a little civil disobedience, so be it. If I was a labor movement, I'd have all the union people there camped out on the Capitol and just dare the governor to arrest you. Just dare him to arrest you because that's what you want, in my opinion. You want this governor to take the next step.
But at the end of this, it has to be peaceful. It has to be organized.
Yes.
This is not
violent. Peaceful.
Exactly. This is what we've been talking about.
Dr. King and Gandhi.
This is important. This is important stuff. And look, Ohio's going to be doing the same thing. We're looking at getting out there to be able to bring you what's going on from there. I wish we could have gone to Wisconsin. I wish we could have been there. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Gary on line one. How are we doing tonight, Gary?
We're not doing too bad, Rick. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I got to be honest with you. I'm energized. I think this is going to backfire in the biggest way in the face of Republicans.
Well, you know, in the market that they're in with the kind of response that seems to be prevalent in that area, you may be right, and I hope it does, and I hope it blows up big. Because I think everybody's looking at this, and here in New York, we've got a new governor here who feels that the way to balance a budget that is drastically bloated is off the backs of a $50,000 a year teacher or a $40,000 a year snowplow driver. So there's going to be a lot of eyes watching this from all over the United States to see just exactly what happened. And testing it the way it's being tested by with such atrocities by bringing out the National Guard. I mean, this is Gestapo sneak at best. But I would like to, if I may, I had the privilege of reading a book here a year or so ago, and I'd like to quote a paragraph from it, and then if you can't, and I'm certain as I get through this, you'll know where it came from. It's a marvelous piece of literature, and it describes very much where, unfortunately, where, as you said earlier, where we've come from in the last 100 years, and this kind of pendulum swing back to this kind of unfortunate labor relation inequity that's taken place. If it's all right with you, I'd like to read that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Here is a population, low class, hanging always on the verge of starvation, and dependent from its opportunities of life upon the whim of men every bit as brutal and unscrupulous as the old-time slave drivers. Under such circumstances, immorality was exactly as inevitably and as prevalent as it was under the system of chattel slavery. Things like these were unspeakable, but they went on in the packing houses all the time, and they were there taken for granted by everybody. Only they did not show as the old slavery times, because there were no difference between the color of the master and the slave. And that's a quote out of
The Jungle.
The Jungle, absolutely,
Upton
by Sinclair
Upton
Lewis.
Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair, rather. If any of your listeners have never had the opportunity or haven't had the opportunity to read a book that gives you the kind of stark realization of where this country was, and you're right, about 100 years ago, this is something that they should pick up and read. And history sounds like it's about to repeat itself. This may be a bit of a stretch, but the fact is, we're going backwards in regards to how this country looks at the people who produce its wealth. And I've never, ever understood this kind of open warfare on middle-class Americans. And I know you've got your opinion as to, you know, it's the upper class or the small percentage of industrialists wanting everything. But they're going to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, and that's you and me.
Yep.
That's the people that go to work and pull their boots on and do their jobs. And I'm you're energized by this, Rick. I'm a little apprehensive. I'm hoping that this pendulum has made its swing, and this action that's being viewed by the rest of America right now, let's hope that this is the pinnacle of that swing.
Well, what I'm hoping, Gary, and I got to be honest, I'm hoping this is that splash in the face of ice cold water that shakes working people awake. I look at this bill by this Jane Cunningham in Missouri wanting to do away with all child labor laws.
I was listening earlier.
I mean, that should shake people awake to realize that these are people who want to take us back to the days of, well, you know, as Jay Gould said, I could pay half the working class to kill the other half.
Yep.
Maybe we wake up. And that's where I'm energized. I think this is a massive overreach that even the people who don't agree with us would agree this is a massive overreach.
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. This is not America. This isn't even America of 100 years ago. This is something that's distorted and by I think anybody who has an ounce of sanity in their head would look at this and say, we're going to take our National Guard and use them against people who want to have a voice in their own jobs, in their own futures, in the workplace. These are not dissidents. These are not extremists. This is not the Ayatollah. This is the guy that lives next door to you. This is the woman that lives down the street. These are the people in your neighborhood who could possibly be, you know, I see flashes of Kent State in front of my eyes again. I'm very concerned, and I hope you're right. I really do, my brother. I hope you're right, because the world, I think, at some juncture will be looking at this, not only people in the United States.
And that's a very good thing, Gary.
You bet.
Very good thing. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Anytime, brother. Take it.
That's the thing, man. With all of the eyes of the world looking to these protests, for Walker to say, I'm going to use the National Guard, I'm going to call out the military, when in Egypt the military was the one who kept the peace, to me that's just really... Generally, the radical right is much better at messaging. Generally, they're much better at selling their position. This was a major screw-up. And I hope they're going to pay for it. I hope this energizes people. I hope this wakes up my Meester brothers who only care about themselves instead of being part of the Teamsters. I hope this wakes up every one of those 51% of the union members who voted for Pat Toomey and say, this is going to destroy us.
That's why part of me wishes that the governor does take it the next step. I'm talking about tonight. If those protesters decide to stay at the Capitol, you know, part of me says, you know, I hope he has them arrested. Let the world see what's going on.
Yep. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this with Mark Anderson, the son of a Teamster. We'll talk about the hidden costs of union busting. We're right back after this.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of the 7 Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to quill.
What's going on in Madison, Wisconsin right now is that moment. You've got to decide which side of this are you on. Are you on the corporate side or are you on the side of the workers? Because this is how this is playing out. And our labor quote of the day comes from Steelworkers President Leo Girard, who said the top priority of the American government must be making America the best place on earth for Americans. If that's good for corporations, great. The government must never place American citizens second. Which is what's going on here in Madison, Wisconsin, and what's been going on to American workers for the last 30 years. You know, I've told my story over the years. I've grown up in a Teamster household. My grandfather was a Teamster truck driver for 21 years. I worked as a Teamster truck driver. It has been a very good living for me and, you know, for my grandparents and for others. But I've seen the hard times. I've seen the strikes. I've seen the lockouts. And it's heartbreaking. So when I saw this article, The Hidden Cost of Union Busting, over at the Daily Kos. I had to track down its author, and that's why I've asked Mark Anderson, who is the son of a Teamster from Local 695 there in Wisconsin. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm looking at your article, and, you know, to be honest, there's a lot there I can identify with. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Well, I guess I'd rather start with my dad's background, if I could, a little bit.
Sure.
My dad was a World War II vet, was in the Navy. After he got out of the Navy after the war, he moved to Madison, Wisconsin. His first job here in Madison was at Oscar Mayer as a, he worked in the unedibles department. He didn't last too long in there. And then he started working for the dairy. He had two kids, and then 13 years after the last child, I came along. So there's kind of two households there. And my dad had worked for the dairy for about 30 years. And, he went to work one day and found a note on his time card saying that his wages had been cut from $12 to $8 an hour.
Wow.
And that his vacation time, instead of being 5 weeks, was 2 weeks. He took that pretty hard. They went to the union, the Teamsters Union, and the owner of the company would not negotiate, which I don't quite understand. My dad never did either, because the guy had the distributorship for milk in the city of Madison pretty much wrapped up. He was in every grocery store, all the schools. He was just after more money.
Yeah. Well, that's what it generally is. It generally is the greed factor.
And that's what it was. And shortly, I think it was probably a month or two. This was about 30 years ago, so I'm trying to remember the details here. But it was a month or two after that my dad had a very minor heart attack. And I remember it very clearly because my mom didn't drive. And a registered letter came that was addressed to my dad, to the house. And it had to get up to the hospital. Well, a friend of mine had won tickets to see a movie. We had to go to the other side of town to get him at the radio station. So we were going to take the bus across town anyway. My mom asked if we could stop at the hospital on the way back to give my dad this letter. And so we did. And my dad did not have his glasses at the hospital. So I had to read it to him. And I was reading it, and I could not believe what I was reading. My dad had just had a heart attack, and it's a letter, registered letter from his boss telling him to come to work tomorrow or he loses his job.
Oh, how compassionate.
Yeah. I'm 14, 15 years old at the time. And I might get a little emotional here, so it's been a while since I thought of this. And, my dad, it was the first time I ever saw my dad cry. It's actually, I think, the only time I've ever seen my dad cry. And, dad went home, I think a week or so later, the union stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. And about this time, they started filing lawsuits, and they'd gone to the National Labor Relations Board, which during the Reagan years, my dad was, a little surprised that they would do that. They didn't think they'd do anything. Well, surprisingly, the NLRB did side with the union on this. His boss was breaking their law, and they were going to file suit against him.
Well, how can you not? I mean, how can you not? If someone's lying in a hospital with a heart attack, how can you not side with that person over an employer who says, if you don't come in tomorrow, we're going to fire you, and then down the road you're going to lose your health insurance and all of that that comes with it? I'm missing the points there.
At that time, because, his boss had been emboldened by the whole air traffic controllers thing, where all of them had been fired.
Right.
And he thought he could get away with doing the same thing, because he wanted a non-union shop. And during this time, the workers, all of my dad's brother truck drivers at the same time, they said, you know what, we're going on strike. And they did. And his boss hired scabs. And at that point, because of the lawsuit, my dad could not drive truck. I don't know if it was a Teamster's rule or something to do with the lawsuit. I'm a little fuzzy on that. But he could not drive a truck while the lawsuit was on. And he ended up taking jobs at all places at Pinkerton, with knowing their history with union.
Right.
It just always amazed me that he took a job with them. And he would work at one of the malls in town on Sundays. And during the weeknights, he would work at the zoo as a security guard, which wasn't even close to what he was making as a truck driver at the time.
But at the end of the day, you've got to feed your family. You got to pay your bills. You got to make ends meet.
Exactly, and that's what he was doing. And, you know, I look back on it, and had I known that my parents were in such dire financial straits, I don't think I would have been the jerk teenager I was. But they were in pretty bad financial straits. And I don't think my brother and sister certainly didn't know it. They were both out of the house at the time. You know, I was the only kid left at home. You know, I was in high school. So I really had no idea. And it started impacting my father severely. My dad had very strong character. He worked hard his entire life. He grew up during the Depression, you know, served in the Navy during the war. You know, you looked at him and you knew he was a hard worker.
Yeah, I mean, working on a milk truck is not easy work.
No, I mean, I really think that, you know, going in and out of cold and hot all day probably shortened his life a little bit, too. But, you know, my dad had a lot of character. And it got to the point where he didn't know why any of this was happening. And he started drinking heavily, which, you know, yeah, my dad, you know, and all my uncles and stuff, they did have, you know, drink a few beers here and there. And there are stories of escapades. But I think those are in every family, you know, but it doesn't mean that there's alcoholism involved. In this case, my dad really started drowning himself in alcohol because he didn't know what else to do.
Right.
And I can remember one night there was a bar a couple blocks from our house, and my mom sent me down to get him, and I had to walk him home. And at the time, I was just dying from embarrassment because, you know, we had to walk past my then-girlfriend's house, and, you know, she saw me, you know, my dad leaning against me, and I'm trying to get him, you know, home, and he's just staggering along. And I feel I lost a good deal of relationship with my father because of what his former employer did. Because I got to the point where I hated my dad because of what he had become. And along the way, because of, you know, the lack of money in the house, any money that had been saved up for me to go to college, which granted would have been the local technical school, was gone. And at that point, my options were go into the Army or go to work for Oscar Myers. Well, Oscar Myers wasn't hiring because there was a recession at the time. And so my only real option at that point was to go into the service. I mean, I didn't finish college until, well, my bachelor's degree, I think I finished, 5 years ago. So it took me that long to catch up. But the worst part is I didn't start having a decent relationship with my father until really about 5 years before he passed away, when I started understanding what he went through.
But at least you had that opportunity. So let me ask you this, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at what's going on today in your neck of the woods, what lessons can we learn from your experience and kind of extrapolate into what's going on in your area today and moving forward there in the event that your governor succeeds in stealing the rights of workers to organize and really to have some of the securities that your father didn't have?
You know, one thing where my dad was lucky was the union did take care of him, and they did eventually win the lawsuit. Where unfortunately, if this does go through, the Wisconsin workers are not going to have that option. The public workers will not be able to sue. They won't be. They will never get their day in court. That's where my dad was lucky, I think. He was able to sue. He was able to get some money for his retirement. He was able to get his insurance. I mean, my mom passed away just last year. If it hadn't been for the Teamsters insurance, I don't know how we could have kept her in the nursing home. So we were, I think, kind of fortunate in that. You know, for the public workers in the state, I know several of them. I mean, my next door neighbor works through the DMV. My other neighbor works for the UW hospital. I have multiple friends that are county plow drivers, you know. They aren't going to have their day in court. This is going to be, it's going to get shoved through the legislature. It's going to get shut on their throats. And it's going to hurt them unless the governor stops this. And the only way he's going to stop it is if the people take over the Capitol right now and send a strong message, don't do this.
No,
that's really the only thing I see.
in looking at some of the news that's coming out, a lot of schools, I'm seeing kids, high school kids leaving their high schools, joining these, joining the protesters, in Madison. I guess one of the schools was your alma mater?
Yeah, East High School, Per Boulder Power. Don't ask me what a Per Boulder is. I don't know. yeah, that school is about 3 miles from the Capitol. You can actually see the Capitol building from the front yard of the school. And I know that my former principal would be very proud of those kids for doing that. And I know tomorrow I've actually seen now that they're talking about closing schools, all of the public schools in Madison, because all the teachers are going to be at the protests. I wish I could be at the protest, but unfortunately tomorrow I have to be at work. It's a really challenging thing, especially with as many friends as I have that work in the public sector. And I have never seen anything like this in my lifetime living here in Madison other than the Vietnam protests that were going on when I was a child here.
Yeah.
And those were scary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let me ask you the last question I've got here. You know, in looking at the people who are out in the street today, how many of them do you think are union members? How many of them are people like you who have you ever been a union member?
I have not been a union member. Both my brother and sister, my sister is a recently retired union member, and mother and his wife are union members today.
So what do you see? How many of the people do you think are there are union members? How many of you think are not? Are just people who are saying, we want to have this right in the future if we choose to go that route?
You know, judging from what I have seen and heard from everybody, I'd say it's about a 50-50 split. You've got 50% of the union folks that are going up there, and 50% are non-union, but they know people who are union. They know people who are in these positions. So I'd say it's probably a good 50-50 split.
Excellent, excellent. Mark Anderson, I appreciate your time. Thank you for writing the piece. I appreciate you coming on the program again. The Hidden Cost of Union Busting. You can get to that article at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mark Anderson's name. Mark, thank you again.
No, thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Waving the flag of freedom, people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Today, back in 1934, U.S. legislators passed the Civil Works Emergency Relief Act, providing funds for Federal Emergency Relief Administration, which funneled money into states plagued by depression, era poverty, and unemployment, and who oversaw the subsequent distribution of relief funds. So basically, they spent some money to get people back to work, which, again, if you go back, Jake, back to what we talked about January of 2009, when we were talking about the stimulus, getting people back to work, creating programs, building projects, all of that stuff to get people back on the paycheck route instead of handing out money in tax cuts, which is what the stimulus did. 40% of the stimulus in the recovery package were handouts instead of paychecks.
Unfortunately, and that cut into the money that was really substantive and effective. If you take a stimulus bill, and it would have been totally effective, and the formula would have been changed for all, I believe it was over $700 billion, and perhaps you could have upped that. And I understand the Democrats, some of the Democrats just didn't have the guts. It probably should have been close to twice that.
Well, you look at Sestak. Then Sestak got beat up for it. Yep. He said it should have been $1 trillion. And I agree with him.
Probably more, but $1 trillion would certainly have increased it by another 30%. He's absolutely right. And at $1 trillion, it's probably bare bones, but it would have been awfully effective. And who knows how far along, how much better we would be, and how much further along on the economic recovery we would be right now.
You know, what's interesting to me is all we keep hearing out of places like Madison, out of the governor's mansions, out of the political right, is how to destroy the conditions of other people's jobs. Not figuring out how to make ours better, but just figuring out how to destroy theirs. And I guess the question that I have is, will making public sector workers poorer make us any richer? Will destroying their working conditions, destroying their health care, destroying their pensions make us any better? Is it going to help me at all? And the reality is, I don't think it's going to. Now, understand, we have some pension problems. And those pension problems are not the fault of the workers. Those pension problems are the fault of Wall Street and the people who have mismanaged the money, the people who have stolen the money, and really this economic downturn. You know, understand, you look at all of the transaction fees and all of the payments that go to Wall Street. And today in the Wall Street Journal, a couple articles in there today about the CalPERS being ripped off by these currency traders. Again, you know, we need to be going after these folks. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Kevin on line one. How are we doing tonight, Kevin?
I'm doing fine. I just wanted to call and express my opinion. I'm going to start off by saying welcome to the Soylent Green economy. You ever remember that sci-fi show movie, Soylent Green?
No, but go ahead.
Charlton Heston?
Sorry, I don't remember that.
Okay, it's basically a sci-fi movie where the substance that people are fighting over end up being food made by people. I mean, they're turning people into food. Basically, we're cannibalizing one another.
Yep.
Okay, and that's what's happening. If you look at the biggest growth industry throughout Mid-America, it's prison. It's prison.
I absolutely agree.
Okay, and, you know, I'm from New York. I'm from New York City, but upstate New York, which, you know, is very similar to, let's say, Ohio, Indiana, you know, the nation's, well, upstate is the beginning of the nation's Rust Belt. You know, that's the growth industry is prisons. And, you know, I was a New York City public school teacher for a year. And one of the reasons why I got out is because in the inner cities and probably in, you know, rural white areas, you know, working, the option of most working class children is either, okay, you work.
Well, I mean, I would assume either you go to go to college, or you go to prison, or you go join the military. I think we got a bad connection with Kevin. I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much. You know, the reality in this, and I think what he was trying to get to is that, you know, there is this lack of opportunity, and this limited of opportunity for people to live what is the American dream. And, you know, I look at what's going on, and I get his point that we're cannibalizing each other. That you've got one set of people who are struggling, looking at someone who's not struggling as much as they are, going, hey, how'd they get more? And then going after them instead of looking at the real problems. And the real problems here is we have a system that is so unequal. And, you know, Kevin from New York, I mean, New York is one of the places in this country that has the widest gap in equity between the have and the have-nots. And, you know, at the end of this, you know, it's going to come down to us fighting back and electing politicians who, quite frankly, are going to do the work in our interest. And I got to tell you, Jake, I'm looking at this, and I am quite hopeful. I am quite hopeful that working people are going to wake up. We're going to give Kevin one more try. How are we doing tonight, Kevin?
Yeah, fine. I'm sorry about that, but my Skype, and I'm calling from 3,000 miles away. I hope you understand.
Oh, yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
And basically what I'm saying, and I see it beginning in the public school system from when they're kids, how, especially in the inner cities, they become more violent. They're just holding pins for children, the sons and daughters of the unemployed, especially in areas that have high populations of people of color.
Okay.
No. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening to your point. Go ahead.
Yeah, and again, like, you know, basically, I'm what you call an American expat. You know, I teach in Asia now, and it's a different mindset over here. Yes, Asia has its problems, you know, especially Korea and China. There is its share of problems, but one of the things is that whole balance. And, you know, it's that yin-yang thing where they do not want to create massive amount of disharmony. You know, in the news, in the for-profit media, they always complain about how the Chinese crush unions and all that stuff. Yes, they do that. But if you're a if you run a corporation or a high public official, you'll be punished very severely for corruption and things of that nature.
Yep. And some of the things we've got to look at, here.
Okay.
I agree. Kevin, I appreciate the call. I got to move along.
Okay, I understand. Have a good one, sir.
Thanks
Bye.
So much. I appreciate it. I mean, the connection, I had a real wow. difficult time there, but I kind of get his point. And mm-hmm. it's something that I think we have to be looking at. And maybe it's happening. Maybe what's going on in Wisconsin is waking people up. And I'm hoping this is that moment. This is that spark that finally shakes away working people who for years identified with the Republicans. Because I think the Republicans really believe they got a mandate.
Well, I think we haven't even talked about this. What let's say the governor wins and all of a sudden slashes benefits and wages. What people don't understand is you have some jobs done by state employees that are sophisticated jobs, require an education. You actually have scientists, you have engineers. Long term, all that's going to do is really decrease the ability pool for your state employees, and maybe that's what they want.
Yep.
So that you can say, well, you know, we're going to have to privatize it. Maybe that is their ultimate aim, but it certainly would hurt in a dramatic way.
We're right back after this. Stick around.
deadly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public workers from across Wisconsin are rallying today at the state capitol in Madison to protest Republican Governor Scott Walker's attempted murder of public worker unions. AFSCME National Secretary Treasurer Lee Saunders says this gutting of collective bargaining rights is part of a nationwide attack on public workers, and in Wisconsin, it's an attempt to destroy AFSCME and other public employee unions.
They are clearly trying to not hurt us in Wisconsin. They're trying to destroy us, and we just cannot let that happen. And we're going to do everything that we possibly can to fight back.
Saunders says this is a mean-spirited attack on workers and an attempt to silence the voices of working families. He said AFSCME, the public unions, and their allied organizations will fight back like never before.
These are people who are your neighbors, your friends, your family members. They go to church with you. They're trying to play by the rules. On average, making around $40,000 a year. Our average pension payment when our folks retire after 30 or 35 years is $19,000 a year. These committed and dedicated public service workers should not be blamed for the economic crisis in this country. To silence their voices just seems to me to be completely counterproductive. And quite honestly, it's un-American to silence those voices of public sector workers.
Last week, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker threw down the gauntlet in the form of proposals that would essentially eliminate the ability of state employees to be represented by labor unions. Jesse Russell reports.
The move has galvanized supporters of public sector workers and even has conservatives that voted for Walker questioning his motives. Brenda Klein, a food service worker in Green Bay, Wisconsin, said she is shocked and angered by the proposals.
I went to the polls last November and voted to protect our freedoms from government threat and create jobs. I never dreamed this would be the result.
When presenting his proposals, Walker said firefighters and law enforcement would be exempt, but that hasn't stopped some workers in the emergency services sector from standing shoulder to shoulder with their coworkers. Janice Bobholz has been employed with the Dane County Sheriff's Department for more than 20 years and also serves as a deputy sheriff. She said as an officer, her job is to protect people from harm, and she wouldn't be doing her job if she let Walker's proposal slide.
If we allow people to deny rights and freedoms to some people, you bet your bottom dollar that in a couple years they'll be coming after everyone else, whether they are police officers or whether they work in a private company.
Bob Yon is a highway employee from Green Lake, Wisconsin, and he said he's a conservative because he wants to keep the government out of individual rights. He added that he hasn't always seen eye to eye with his union and explained why this case is different.
The issue of denying people their rights, I am in full agreement with the union. In fact, I've never been more energized to go out and fight with the tens of thousands of public employees across this state.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, that's it. Right now. Right now is the time to get involved. You know, look, this what's going on in Wisconsin is going to go to Ohio next week. It could end up right here in Pennsylvania in the next couple of weeks. The governor's budget is coming out March 8th. We're going to be talking about that. I think that's an important moment. But the reality is we've got to be ready for these kind of attacks here locally as well. Because if all goes the way some are saying in Wisconsin, it's going to roll into Ohio. It's going to roll into Indiana, into Michigan, into New Jersey, here into Pennsylvania. It could be the destruction of the working American dream. That dream that if you work hard and you play by the rules that you can get ahead. And that's why we got to fight back. Anyway, I want to thank Kevin for calling in. The Skype connection was a little bad, so I'm sorry if I wasn't able to respond because I had a real hard time with that. But I appreciate you listening and tuning in. Thank you. If you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I am interested in everyone's point of view and having that discussion moving forward. Again, rick@therickSmithShow.com. The Borowitz Report heads off. Ahmadinejad promises democratic reforms in Egypt. Andy Borowitz writes, in a dramatic address to pro-democracy protesters in Tehran, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad promised the people of Iran that there would soon be democratic reforms in Egypt. Ahmadinejad told protesters, "Your call for democratic freedoms has been heard loud and clear, and soon they will be instituted in Egypt, where you can go visit them." He said that every Iranian who thirsts for democracy should rejoice at it blossoming such a short plane ride away. In an effort to cater to the social media habits of Iran's youth, Mr. Ahmadinejad said that the Iranian government would soon establish a Facebook page for democracy, and he would permit the protesters to click like, so they would be able to click on like. The Iranian president said that democracy in nearby Egypt plus a democracy-themed Facebook page shows that the Iranian government is bending over backwards to listen to its people. He told the crowd, "I know that you want democracy, but for the time being, you'll just have to settle for hypocrisy." Elsewhere, democracy continues to sweep everywhere. Middle Eastern country George W. Bush did not invade. So democracy sweeping across the countries that our former shrub of a president did not invade. And the question, you go back and you look at this, and what does that teach us? What should we be learning about Iraq? What should we be learning about Egypt? If you remember, going back to the beginning of our program, I said right from the start, going in and occupying a country, that's no way to start a democracy. You cannot have democracy at the point of a gun. It has to come from the people. It has to be a groundswell of support from the bottom up. The Iraqis, the Iranians, young people, part of social media, they see what's going on in the rest of the Western world, and they wanted part of that. You know, what happened in Iran a number of years ago, before we invaded Iraq, was this movement. The young people wanted Western reforms. As soon as we invaded Iraq, all of that stopped, and we ended up with a crazy guy like Ahmadinejad.
Right, absolutely. Oh, and by the way, under Iraq, you find more and more of the former spokesmen for the talk about cabinet members of the Bush administration who were making excuses. Now they don't try to make any excuses. You find out more evidence that it was half trumped up, and some of the people that they were listening to within Iraq were just bent on getting Saddam Hussein out of power.
You mean Curveball was wrong?
Curveball was absolutely wrong.
Curveball was a screwball, and we bought into it.
Well,
and we gave him a whole boatload of money.
However, I think that's really letting the neocons off, because they were, let's be honest, let's be totally frank, they were predisposed in invading Iraq long before their decision was made. You're going back in the late 90s. I mean, they publicly said it. I mean, these guys must think that the attention span of the average American is that short. And maybe it is, but the truth is, they were on public record, and it wasn't just one. It was three or four of them were on public record as to why we should use military power to expand American influence in Iraq specifically. And I know this is going to shock people. Some of you better sit down. It was, one, to protect oil supply, and two, to set up an American base in the Middle East to better protect Israel. They said that, and they were looking of just a scintilla. In fact, tonight on MSNBC, they got back into some of the public records of the Secretary of Defense, and he actually said it wasn't that they had weapons of mass destruction, but that they were thinking about it. Now, let's think about that. We invaded a country on the premise that, well, they were thinking about developing nuclear weapons. How many countries would that qualify for invasion, Rick? Several dozen? I mean, if you think about the invasion of Iraq, which has caused this country so much, it is absolutely, it stupefies me to this day how we allowed these people to get away with it. And now, here we are. Here we are. We have an arch enemy in Iran who could have been our ally. There could have been a democratically elected moderate government in Iran. We've lost over 40,000 men and women in combat, tens of thousands permanently injured. Total cost, I'm sorry, you're right. It was over 4,000. Still, over 4,000 is 4,000 dead. I apologize for that. But I was accurate on the tens of thousands of permanently injured. The estimates long-term rank, if you're factoring in taking care of the injured, over between $3 and $4 trillion, which could come in handy right now.
Which, you know, when you look at the budget, and, you know, I look at the numbers that they're talking about. You know, had we not spent all that money, had we not squandered our treasury, what could we afford? What would our deficit look like? Now, remember, go back to 2000. Before Bush is elected, we've got a Fed chair in Alan Greenspan who's looking into the future without an idea of what to do, because we were going to pay off our debt so fast, the country would be debt-free, we would have all this money. They had no idea what the future looked like because, oh, my God, we've got this surplus. We've got these massive surpluses as far as the eye can see. Everything was smoking along. All of a sudden, we got George W. Bush appointed President of the United States. We have a recession. 9/11 happens. Then we have a massive, massive collapse. And we are still digging out of that. This is not the result of a bunch of workers asking for a reasonable living. This is the result of years of poor decision making at the top, years of Wall Street having unfettered control, and years of the thievery class at the very top stealing from you and I.
And how much money to this day hasn't been accounted for? You know, hundreds of millions of dollars just in Iraq.
We have no idea where that money was spent.
It's gone.
We have no idea. And you've heard me say this a number of times. Where is this generation's Harry Truman? Where is the guy who's going to hold those hearings, hold these contractors accountable, hold the Pentagon accountable? Where's our Harry Truman? And I don't care who it is. If Rand Paul stepped forward and said, I want to know where every penny is and I'm going to hold hearings, I would say Rand Paul's a great guy for doing that. Now, he's got some kooky ideas other than that, but you know what? He'd be right there, just like he's right about examining the Patriot Act, which, by the way, has passed. When are we going to do that? When are we going to demand to know where our money was spent? You know, when you're talking about social programs that help people heat their homes, and there's going to be money cut from LIHEAP. When you're talking about making sure that infants have milk and have some substance in their stomach through the WIC programs, we're going to be cutting those programs. Down the list, you go.
Don't forget education, Rick. $100 billion in 10 years, Pell grants and major. Programs which help the average person get an education, which in many cases is the only lifeline they have out of a life of poverty.
And you go back to what's happened, how we got here, and the story that we're being told, the line we're being fed, the you know, I keep thinking of the S word that's being jammed down our throat, that our faces are being mashed in. It's all wrong. All of this is because we have given too much control to too few people with no oversight. We have told the criminals on Wall Street, oh, please, make us all millionaires. And I go back to my 401k when I started my job back in 1993, working for a trucking company. They told me, Rick, in 30 years, you are going to be a millionaire. And being a younger man, I said, I got to be honest with you, there's no way that the powers to be, the investor, the owners of this country are going to let a dumb trucker have $1 million. And I'm sitting on about 100 and 150 here, you know, 18 years later.
I can remember the commercials on TV, early 80s, when the 401k. That was right around the time when the provisions in the tax code were passed. And they were saying, well, you can give $2,000 a year, blip, 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 X number of years at X number percent. magically $1 million. If I could make a comment on Iraq yet, I mean, that whole cesspool, from Abu Ghraib to the disappearance of hundreds of millions of dollars to Blackwater, how many people have been brought to justice on so many things that need to be answered for that haven't been? And where are the investigations? I mean, we blame the Bush administration, but where's the integrity and where's the courage, moral courage, to shine some light on that on Congress's part? Where is it?
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Most of us would not consider $600,000 to be good pay for a year's work. We'd consider it to be a bonanza. But then, we're not a Wall Street greedhead. Lloyd Blankfein, however, is. As boss banker at Goldman Sachs, he was not happy to draw only $600,000 last year, so he recently got Goldman's compliant board to more than triple his base salary this year to $2 million. Bear in mind that base salary on Wall Street is just for showing up, not the total pay they haul off at year's end. Bonuses, stock options, and other bundles of money are thrown in to rocket executive pay into the greedosphere. Add up all the extras, and Blankfein's total take last year was not a peonish $600,000, but $13.2 million, plus a limousine, of course. It's useless, though, to try telling Lloyd that such pay is excessive, unseemly, greedy. He's measuring what he got last year in terms of the haul he made in 2007, when he and his merry band of banksters were busy crashing our economy, costing millions of Americans their jobs, homes, and middle-class hopes. For his splendid work that year, Blankfein made off with more than $68 million in personal pay. Still, grabbing a $13 million paycheck last year, while, thanks in part to him, millions of people got no paycheck at all, puts the triple I in narcissistic. Blankfein's flaming sense of self-worth is magnified by the fact that Goldman Sachs had a lousy 2010. Its stock value stagnated, profits plummeted by a third, and it had to pay $500 million for defrauding its own customers. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this failure on the watch of a guy who now feels entitled to a bigger paycheck. As a symbol of Wall Street's mindless greed-headedness, Lloyd Blankfein bobblehead dolls should be distributed across America. Better yet, how about Blankfein voodoo dolls?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
That's the hope. That is the hope. And I got to tell you, I think the Tea Party, I think all the Tea Twizzlers and my Tea Twit friends, I think they've been fooled. I think those working class people who went out and they really believed that these Republicans were going to bring about change. They were really going to go in there and they were going to clean up Washington. They were going to clean up Harrisburg. They were going to clean up Madison, Wisconsin. I really believe in their heart of hearts, they were misled into believing that these Republicans, these constitutional, God-loving, God-country, they were going to clean things up. But we've seen here in Harrisburg, no accountability, no reform, no transparency. It's going to be jamming stuff down our throats like they're doing in Wisconsin, like they're trying to do in Ohio. It's all about their ideology, and it's all about punishing those who disagree with them. And you look at Talking Points memo. Pointed out that if the Republican House succeeds in cutting tens of billions of dollars in discretionary spending over the next 6 months, there are going to be a lot of federal employees out on the street. And according to John Boehner, that's okay. He said if some of those jobs are lost, so be it. So be it. Remember Dick Cheney with his so? Here's that so moment. You got Boehner saying, well, yeah, so be it. So be it. So what if we lose all these jobs? Again, going back to this big lie. And the right, they never question. They never question the big lie. Because Boehner said, citing some source, and you know where he got it? That's right. He reached behind him, reached down, got a good grip, and popped it right out. And there it is. 200,000. Obama added 200,000 workers to the federal payroll. Didn't you hear that? He went right out. And here it is. First time it saw sun. 200,000. The reality is it was only 20,000. But hey, you know, what's one digit? You can't hold Boehner accountable. And I keep asking, where are the jobs, man? At least Obama created 20,000 jobs. Put people back to work. Now, when you go and kick all these people off the federal rolls, guess what's going to happen? We're going to pay them to sit home. We're going to pay them unemployment. We're still going to pay them. And you know what? We're going to have to contract out the work that they were doing to somebody else for more money. And it's going to cost us more in the long run. I got to tell you, I look at these people, and I'm just, oh. I mean, what have Republicans come up with since they've taken power? What have their ideas been? Oh, yeah, do away with child labor laws, abortion, repeal Obamacare. Where are the jobs? Surely there is a dyed-in-the-wool, hollow-headed, vacant-eyed conservative out there with something, anything, to defend their brethren. Please, if there's a conservative out there, I want to hear what the conservatives have done since taking power. All I want, just one thing that has benefited the working people of this country. One thing. Because certainly there's some hollow-headed, vacant-eyed conservative out there. Just one. Because how do you defend Scott Walker? How do you defend what's going on in Congress? There are no jobs plans. In fact, they want to cut job training programs. They want to throw people out onto the street who lost their jobs because of their insane trade policies. But that's okay. Because they're cutting those people off the budget. It's insane, Jake.
Yeah, but
insane.
It's even better. Do you remember when they said, when they came in power, we are going to zero in like a laser on job creation?
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's look at their record. Just, something unimportant like the truth. Number of Republican bills offered on jobs, zippo. Number of hearings and job creation ideas, nada. Number of votes of job creation measures, nary a one. So a grand total of 000 the last time I checked. Thanks to my public school education, 000 adds up to nothing. False promises, big fat lies.
Look, at the end of it, they don't have a clue. All they're good at is sloganeering. All they're good at is campaigning. Look at what this idiot in Wisconsin did. I mean, this was really the bonehead move of the century. When we look back in a year or two, him saying, I'm going to call out the National Guard, I'll put those people in place. Really very, very boneheaded.
Well, just to show you how they play the game, and I understand it's politics and every party does it, but just about those numbers they were criticizing the president on, adding 20,000 more federal employees since Obama came in.
200,000.
200,000?
Boehner said 200,000.
Well, the report I have in front of me says 20, but let's not bicker. The point is this. What they forgot to tell you is that if you take the number of federal employees on a per capita basis per 1,000 Americans, it's the lowest since at least 1962. So Obama's done a good job in that respect, but they're not going to tell you that. They're not going to give him any credit for anything. As usual, they tell you half a story. Job creation, Republicans, nothing. All they know is to cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes, cut tax breaks to the rich and the corporate interest.
You know what they do know how to do? You know what Republicans really know how to do well? Do you know? They know how to go to Super Bowls on someone else's dime.
They're pretty good at that.
They know how to take corporate money and go on a trip.
Mm-hmm. Like Scarnati.
Days after the Philadelphia Inquirer revealed Senate President pro tempore Joseph Scarnati had his Super Bowl trip covered by Consol Energy, the Senate Republican who has blocked efforts to end Pennsylvania's status as the only major gas-producing state without a drilling tax, announced that he would repay the energy giant for the trip. Filed that one under necessary but not sufficient, according to Hypocrisy Watch. As the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette editorialized today, it's time for him to take the lead, backed with the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, and forbid officials from accepting significant gifts from anyone doing business with the government. And I got to be honest, I actually thought that they had done that kind of stuff already.
Other states had.
Well, I thought here in Pennsylvania, maybe.
I believe Common Cause had introduced legislation that wasn't passed.
Under the banner of all this reform and all the teetwizzlers who came in and said, we're going to change things. What's changed? The only thing that I see changing is that they're doing a nice job of trying to limit the minority party from having any voice in any legislation.
Well, first of all, Senator Scarnati said, you know, this kind of thing won't have any impact. But it was ironic the way it came down when the story broke. Philadelphia Bulletin, I believe, Rick. His first reaction was, well, gee, I don't know. I haven't got the numbers back from the company that's paying for all this. And what he was talking about, Rick, I believe the state law says that if you get anything like this over the value of $600, I believe the IRS requires you to then claim that as a gift. But him saying that is really hiding the real question. The real question is, why did he go to the Super Bowl at their expense in the first place when there's legislation in front of him, him being very key in the Pennsylvania Senate? Why would you not at all costs avoid any even appearance of conflict of interest? Now, I personally believe it does have an impact. He can say no. Him and the governor can say no all day, but we, you know, at the end of the day, common sense dictates it does have an influence. But beyond that, why would you even go there at their dime? That's the question.
Because he thinks he's above the law. He thinks nobody's going to catch him. At the end, you break rules, you do these kind of things because you think nobody's watching. Also from our friends at Hypocrisy Watch, rallying the GOP base this weekend, Governor Tom Corbett warned Republican activists Saturday that keeping his promise to balance Pennsylvania's deficit threatened state budget without a tax increase will require drastic measures, and cautioned that breaking the vow would likely erase the party's impressive gains in last year's election. And, you know, the question that they have is, how? How about the non-political ramifications of this year's budget? After all, it's the Corbett administration that just this month created a $338 million hole in next year's education budget. Any plans to fill that hole, or are we just going to pass the buck on to local property tax holders? And again, you know, as Corbett holds firm, and I told you he's going to, he is not going to do what George H.W. Bush did and go back on his pledge. Because you saw what happened to H.W. Bush, even though I agreed with him and he was right for doing what he did. Corbett learned that lesson. He is not going to go back on that pledge. And we at the local level, the local taxpayers are going to be the ones who get stuck holding the bag, paying the freight for his political ploy. Understand that, because it is coming. When the school districts can't get money from the state to fill their budgets, they're going to get it from somewhere. That's you. Also from Hypocrisy Watch, time to choose powerful health insurance companies versus 40,000 working Pennsylvanians. More than 40,000 working Pennsylvanians will lose their health insurance at the end of the month unless Governor Corbett asks his insurance company allies to step in. Today in the Patriot News, they take up the issue. Some 40,000 people will lose their health insurance by February 28th, about the same number of people who live in the city of York. Corbett should have asked the Blues to contribute to the adult basic health insurance program until the end of the fiscal year, given the Blues' mandated charitable obligation and $5.6 billion surpluses. This would seem reasonable. It's not too late. You'd be surprised how quickly big business can act if it's important to their governor. And again, you know, this is that adult basic situation where, you know, we've talked to a couple people who have had it. It's a lifeline. It's that last thing that helps keep them working. And for me, that's the big part of it. We want to encourage people working. We want to reward that and say, you know what? You know, we understand you're having a tough time. We're going to help you with this.
And by the way, this is finger in the dike with this problem. And it just points out for the thousandth time why we need universal coverage of health care. There are 42,000 on this plan right now, but there's another 440. 440,000, more than 10 times that, waiting to get on it, just in Pennsylvania.
And our last bit from our friends at Hypocrisy Watch. The Senate Education Committee will hear testimony tomorrow on an expensive new program that uses taxpayer funds to pay for private school vouchers. And at least one group has been getting ready for the hearing. The Students First PAC, the pro-voucher PAC, who gave $312,500 to 7 of the 11 members of the Senate Education Committee from June to December 2010. Both Republicans and Democrats have benefited from the PAC's largesse. Everyone. In fact, except 4 current committee members who weren't on the panel last year. So the voucher people, they're buying their, let's put it a nicer way. They're investing in our politicians so that they get a good return on that said investment. Again, you know, these vouchers, bad idea all the way around, especially now. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're back after this.
Changing America for the better.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Your proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Do the Wall Street Shuffle.
right now. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can get the podcast right there. If you want to contact me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We do answer all emails. How's that deregulation working out for you? How's that privatization working out? You know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're going to be talking about nothing but privatization for the next couple of months because they want to hock off all the state assets. And it's just not Pennsylvania. It's all across the country. You know, as we have these budget holes, you know, they want to start fire sailing off state assets for a quick fix. Personally, I think deregulation and privatization are a big part of the reason we're in the mess we're in, especially deregulation of the electric industry here in Pennsylvania, which we've known for a long time, was a bad idea. You know, when last year when they bestowed the wonders of deregulation upon me, my rates shot up 36%. Lucky me. Ooh. Now, according to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, a report released on Monday concludes that electric deregulation has cost Texas residents about $11 billion in higher rates, and that operators of the state's major power grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, has been poorly managed and industry dominated. The 101-page report titled The Story of ERCOT, ERCOT, finds that deregulation has resulted in higher rates for Texas power consumers rather than the lower rates forecasted by lawmakers who passed the state law back in 1999. Gee, that sounds familiar. I think I've heard that before. I think, and maybe I'm wrong, that there were commercials all over the radio back in the mid-90s here in Pennsylvania saying, I still remember the one, the guy goes up to heaven and he wants a choice of where he's going to go, and God goes, where do you think you are? Pennsylvania? Because, you know, we consumers of electricity, we're going to get this great choice. We were going to have options. And as we find out here in Texas, the option is, well, bend over, because deregulation has really zapped our wallets. According to the article, before deregulation, Texas had cheaper rates than most states between 99 and first 6 months of 2010. However, Texas residential consumers suffered greater increases in electricity rates than residents in all but six other states, according to the report. The report goes on to say, had electric prices remained at the national average, not below it, just at it, Texas residential consumers would have saved more than $11 billion since the implementation of regulation, according to the report, citing data compiled by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The entire deregulated Texas market, commercial, industrial, and residential, would have saved $15.5 billion had prices remained at the national average. Now, I look at this and I say, you know, again, this whole deregulation scheme, and we've talked about this a number of times, is just a theft from the working people of this country. It's a direct theft from your wallet to the investor class, to the very wealthy class. Because they're the ones who control this stuff. And how many people have the opportunity or the choice to turn off their electricity? It's a monopoly. Understand, it's a monopoly. There's no competition there. You have no choice. It is what it is. You're stuck with it. It's not like you can go, well, you know what? Take your wires out of my house. I'm going to go with what? Nothing. So we should look at it the way it is. It's a monopoly.
And that's the way it was. Originally, it was set up with just that idea. It's a monopoly, therefore, it has to be regulated.
Yeah, we got this great idea that somehow we're smarter than hundreds of years of history. Somehow the people on Wall Street, the big money people who dream this stuff up, are smarter. Well, wait a minute. They are smarter. You know why? Because in Texas, they figured out how to get $15.5 billion out of their consumers to put into the pockets of the investor class. I think that's pretty brilliant. And here in Pennsylvania, you had advocacy groups going, yeah, we want it. I want the choice. I want to know who's going to stick it to me. Without a voice, of course. I mean, isn't that what's happened? And now the rates have come down a little bit because we've had a major economic collapse. But as soon as this economy turns back around, you know where the rates are going to go.
Unfortunately, when these people promised all this wonderful, wonderful rate structure was going to keep going down and down and down because of increased competition. When they're found out to either flat out lied to you or dead wrong, you can't go back and hold them to their promises, unfortunately.
You look at stories that are coming out right now. The headline reads, Shell report predicts peak oil now or soon. Ponders Depression 2.0. And what they're saying is, look, we're not running out of oil. We're running out of oil that we can get. And they're saying, Shell is saying, we're almost at peak oil, where it's all downhill from here. And they're forecasting energy scenarios through 2050 that the oil giant predicted a growing volatility in the price of oil and a coming period of, quote, extraordinary opportunity or misery. And then you push that forward and you look at what Exxon is saying in their Wall Street Journal piece today. They're struggling to find new oil. They're struggling to find oil that they can get to. At some point, don't we need to have an energy policy that encourages renewable energy? Because right now, a couple of the biggest oil companies are saying, hey, folks, now look, this could be them saying, hey, we're going to jack the price up so we can profit off of this now. But understand, they're not going to come out and say, we're in trouble, unless we're in trouble.
Well, the truth is, we do need to get this news called oil around our neck. We need to get over it. But here's the thing, Rick. I've heard, and I've seen some studies where, you know, big oil does have, they purchase all kinds of rights throughout the country. And I think in some instances, probably a lot of instances, they're waiting to the optimum time. It just wouldn't pay enough to suit their investors at this time.
Right. Well, what they're saying is, look, we're not out of oil. In fact, there is the largest oil find in the world underneath the Rocky Mountains. Question is, are you going to get to it? They know where it is. It's just how expensive does oil then have to be for them to extract it? That's really the problem here. Are we willing to pay $20 a gallon for gas? Because if we got to start going through the Rocky Mountains to get down to that oil formation, that's what it's going
to
cost you.
Me, I'm willing to pay considerably more if those taxes that I'm going to pay for each gallon of gas goes for building our infrastructure, like in Europe. Why do you think the Europeans are so far ahead of us? Because the price of gas in Europe for years has been $5, $6, $7 a gallon.
Well, they've been paying the true cost of it. I mean, you understand, we've been subsidizing those industries for years. I mean, we have these transportation bills. And here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're going to be talking about another transportation bill that can be funded with taxpayer dollars when it should be funded through a higher gas tax. But politically, saying we're going to double or triple the gas tax is suicide politically.
Well, a part of me says maybe that's what needs to happen. One, if we do it right, and that's a big if, politically it would be tough. But if we're willing to say, look, we need to higher taxes, put that money in a fund that we're going to use to build our infrastructure. And two, I know me personally, and I'm sure you, if the price of gas is $7 an hour, $7 a gallon, you're going to really put a premium on when you're going to use your car.
If, you know, and I've said this before, if I had the opportunity to ride a train into Harrisburg to go to work every day, I would, without question, I would do it. You know, my wife and I, when my truck blew up, or just stopped, my poor truck just stopped. You know, 250,000 miles.
That's pretty good mileage.
You know, it's time. When it stopped, we talked about if it were possible for us to be a one-vehicle household. And the reality is that we can't. I cannot get back and forth to work without a vehicle. If we had public transportation that was viable, quite possible. But not in this day and age. Maybe down the road, maybe with some smart leadership, people who are running Cumberland County, maybe some smart leadership will move us in that direction. And there's a Cumberland County race coming up. We've had candidate Mike Fedora on the program a couple of times. Seems like a bright guy. Seems to have some leadership ideas on how to move Cumberland County forward. We'll see.
Well, how bad does it have to get in this country? Look at 83. Here we are, 81. Major route. 81. 81 sometimes is just bumper to bumper to bumper, mile after mile after mile after mile. Look at the lag that we had going to Washington, D.C. For 50 miles. Now, you were asleep. You didn't see it all, but I was driving. For 50 miles, we were going 15, 20 miles an hour, and then you'd move ahead every now and then. You'd go up to 50 and 60, and then we would be back to 15, 20 miles an hour for 50, 60 miles outside of Washington, D.C., the capital of this nation.
Yep.
And you and I talked about it. I would have much preferred to take a relaxing ride in a train. I would have, if I could have gotten a ticket from Harrisburg to Washington, Washington back to Harrisburg, I would have gladly paid them $100.
Yeah, well, there you go. And that's something we're going to have to talk about. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester
Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, you can forgive, but you can't forget. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Well, that's at least what the Republicans want you to believe. They want you to believe whatever it is they pop out of their keister and shove in front of you. Mike emails me, and again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, the reality is, you know, Boehner came up with his 200,000 new federal jobs. If some of those jobs are lost, well, and so be it, he said. Mike writes, where you been there, Boehner? Your argument just isn't relevant or valid. POTUS beat you to the punch, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Mike writes, the last 3 months, the Fed has shed 67,000 government jobs. Unbelievable, he writes. The right can't even come up with anything original. The fact that our Speaker of the House is so misinformed is scary. Mike writes, if I were in his shoes, I would be darn sure that I had the correct information before opening my mouth. Just my two cents. I appreciate the email, Mike. And again, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all personally. The big news, big epidemic, evidently, you know, big CDC problem. Agency France-Presse reports a mystery illness has infected some 170 people. They were the attendees of an internet conference in Los Angeles. It was hosted by none other than Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion. They're saying that of the 700 internet professionals from 30 countries who attended, about 170 have come up with this illness, where symptoms consist of fever, chills, general discomfort, and some coughs. The illness was first reported on Sunday, and they contacted the California Department of Public Health. I got to be honest, you know, when I first heard about an illness going through the Playboy Mansion, I didn't think of, you know, something like the flu. I thought of, you know, gonorrhea, syphilis, herpes, you know, that kind of stuff. But evidently they had this smoke machine that must have put this water vapor into the air, causing this Pontiac fever, they're saying, which is making people sick.
I had heard it described as kind of a quasi-legionnaire disease. But
yep. So there you go. Risk getting sick at the Playboy Mansion.
And by the way, the old man's getting married again. Some young 25-year-old. Hey, if it keeps him young, God bless him.
Yeah, here's the thing. You know, if I'm, what's he, like 80?
He's in his 80s.
If I'm 80 years old and I can still get a 23-year-old or 25-year-old, God bless
him. I'm sure it's all his magnetic personality. It has nothing to do with his net worth, right, Rick? Well, if you ask the girl, I'm sure she'll say, love him.
He's wonderful.
I love him to death.
An Ecuadorian court has ordered oil giant Chevron to pay $8.6 billion to clean up pollution it caused in a local rainforest. The funny part here is that Chevron denies it caused the pollution, but the judge has ordered the fine to be doubled if the company doesn't apologize within 15 days. You gotta love these.
Double it?
Yeah, gonna double it. You gotta love these Ecuadorian courts. If you don't apologize, if you don't say you're sorry, we're gonna double it. That's pretty amazing.
I think it's kind of funny, actually.
I think it's amazing that a court actually found them guilty of, an oil company guilty of something. Heck, we can't do that. So good for them.
Yes. Every now and then the Republicans do some things that are right. Well, apparently, today there was a vote in the Senate, and by 51-47, the proposal to deny union the rights of transportation security officers, their unionization rights, it was voted down. The measure was introduced, by the way, by three Republicans, Senator Roger Wicker from Mississippi, Susan Collins from Maine, and Tom Coburn from Oklahoma. It was an amendment put onto the 2011 FFA authorization bill after TSA Administrator John Pistole affirmed the TSO's right to bargain earlier this month. And I want to quote what Tom Harkin said. I think it's very appropriate. This is what Tom Harkin said. He said, the Capitol Police officers and Federal Protective Service officers have collective bargaining rights. First responders on 9/11 who not only risked their lives, but some of them who gave their lives were union members, and so should the TSOs, and I say amen for that. Long overdue. It was taken away from them. It was a political stunt by the Bush administration sometime early in the Bush administration's first couple years, and to get those rights back, I think that's a very positive result. Glad to see some of the Republicans come on board.
There you go. Good. Anyway, a big day today in Wisconsin. Tomorrow we're going to pick up much of that sentiment, because I think I'm anxious to see if the folks are going to stay overnight. I'm anxious to see if they're going to hold out. And you know, maybe we see this play out on the national stage. Maybe we see the working people of Wisconsin say, you know what? We're going to make our stand. We're going to make sure that our workers are protected. We're going to make sure that we're not the catalyst for the destruction that the Republicans want to wage on workers in this country. I mean, if you cannot save one of the core tenets of our Constitution, the right of association, the right of redress of your government, the right to petition, I don't know what you stand for, which is why I think this is the moment of our time. This is what we need to be paying attention to. And tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Also, some things on the state level that I think are important. You know, as we move forward, there's going to be some fights right here at home. So we're going to talk about that. Also, we're going to get somebody from the Center for American Progress to talk about the GOP hit squad at the International Chamber of Commerce and the spy jobs that they've been doing on their political opponents. Understand, right now, it's payback time. The extreme right, they see the opportunity, and they're coming. They got their guns out, they're loaded, and they're ready to go. What are we going to do? How are we going to fight back? How are we going to repel this aggression? That's what it comes down to, folks. It comes down to organizing. It comes down to us getting together and fighting back. It is that simple. We've been here before. These battles will come. And we've got to stand up to the challenge. Anyway, I want to thank everybody who was on the program tonight. Our good friend Frank M. Speck from Workers Independent News. Cy Khan, just an amazing author, singer, songwriter, and an all around good guy. And Mark Anderson, the writer of The Cost of Union Busting. I want to thank all of them. Thank you for your calls. I want to thank Brett for sliding the tubes and turning the knobs. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the blood of sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. The must is coming.